The views and opinions expressed by the guests on the following program do not necessarily represent those of Mark Radio, The Shepherd, or its advertisers.
From the studios of the Shepherd Radio Network, it's Afternoons with Mike. This next hour is all about our walk with Jesus, with local pastors, newsmakers, people who are making a difference for the gospel. Now, here is your host, Mike Gilland.
Welcome back to the second of our special in a series that is aimed at opioid awareness. Hi there, Mike Gilland here. This is Afternoons with Mike. I'm being joined in the studio with a couple of colleagues. First of all, to my left is JC Derrick, and JC is the publisher of our digital newspaper within Mark Media up in Gainesville, where that is. And he is with me here in the studio today, as is Brittany Parks, who is our director of development for The Shepherd. And both are joining us for this special series that we're doing, four episodes, and basically broken down in this following format. Number one is we looked last week at the problem with addicts and addiction. Today, we're going to talk about and hear some stories about how family members are affected. And Brittany, I'd like to turn to you. I know that you and your family were deeply affected by this problem with drug abuse, and it did make a major impact into your own family. Tell us about that.
In 2010 is when my family found out my brother was struggling with a drug problem issue, and we really had no idea until I was coming home junior year from Christmas break. My mom came up to get me from school, and we were driving down, and my mom got a phone call from my dad that he couldn't wake up my brother. And my mom said, "What do you mean you can't wake up Brandon? Brandon is 5'8", 16 years old." But it was Christmas break, like I said. I'll always remember, because my grandpa's birthday is the 18th, and she picked me up on the 17th. And that very next day, we went to my grandpa's birthday party, his 70th birthday party, and acted like nothing happened when my brother had just overdosed, because we didn't want anyone to know. No one in our family knew. We had just found out, and it was more of a shock. It's a stain. It's not something that you're just going to call a family member and be like, "This just happened." Four of us were just in shock and awe and crying and lucky that he was alive. So the very next day, Brandon got up like nothing happened. We got ready and we went to my grandpa's 70th birthday party and just said hello to everybody. And, you know, like, "Oh, how's college? Everything's going good. Brandon's in high school. You know, life is normal," when we were just eating it up inside. Mm-hmm. And only the four of us knew.
Mm-hmm. And that started off the trail of problems. How long did that go on?
It went until November 4th of 2015 is when Brandon lost his battle to addiction.
Mm-hmm. These problems that these kids have and are having, many of them are kind of a scenario that happens with partying. But many of them, JC, many of them are coming about because of an injury or because of an accident for which doctors have prescribed a medication. And often that medication is one of these opioids.
Yeah, that's true. There are numerous reasons, some of them completely innocent, for people being led down this path. And I think we can say pretty much without exception, no one sets out to become an addict. You know, in all the cases, this is something that just develops and entraps people. Mm-hmm. And has become just a huge problem in our culture.
Our first guest on this episode today is Mary Beth Moore Zacco. Mary Beth lost her son, Ryan, to this very problem. And I think her story is going to be applicable to many. It's one of those stories that, while very painful, there are aspects to it that we can all learn and really apply. So this is Mary Beth Moore Zacco. Mary Beth, thank you for coming in. And you're here today because of just a couple of years ago, you lost Ryan, your son. Tell us a little bit, first of all, about your project that you have. And it is one that is designed in such a way that it says a message with its own name.
Yes. Well, thank you for having me. The reason I'm here is because I lost my 25-year-old son, Ryan, 27 months ago, December 17th, 2018, to, at that time, what I called an accidental overdose. I was told it was heroin laced with fentanyl. Mm-hmm. I have since learned that it was just fentanyl that took my son. But what I created in his honor is called the From Project, and From means Forever Ryan's Mom.
Mm-hmm.
It's important to me that just because he's not here physically with us, that it takes away from my being a mom mm-hmm. and my having a son. And if you look at how the From Project is written, it's all capitals except for the O in From, which is small. Because when people hear that your son died of an overdose or substance use disorder, they get very quiet. And usually the comment is just, oh, and that's the end of it. And it shouldn't be the end of it.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know, when you talk about opioids and mm-hmm. even fentanyl, as we have uncovered in some of our interviews so far, we found that this drug, which was, or, you know, at least we all thought it, we knew about it. We thought it was going to be a very useful drug for pain. And it has become something of a monster all by itself. So you mentioned the heroin laced with fentanyl. That is a common problem. People who sell drugs will purposefully do this to heighten the addictability.
Absolutely. As I've come along in my grief journey, I've come along in my understanding mm-hmm. about fentanyl. It was just a word that I knew on the news.
Mm-hmm.
But now from my research and my findings, drug dealers are putting it in everything, every single street drug there is. There is no safe street drug. Fentanyl can be found in marijuana. There is fentanyl in Xanax, Percocet. A lot of our children are dying from overdose because they think they're getting a Percocet
mm-hmm.
or a Xanax. And it's pure fentanyl. It's not used with the intent that it came out with for pain management.
You'd think, why would they do that? Well, let's just stop there and think, well, they're just trying to make a buck and they don't care at all about the person's lives or,
right.
or the families that are affected. And of course, mm-hmm. this particular week of our series is really aimed at the pain that family members and friends have in such a time of loss.
And now a new thing I've encountered is hearing that people that suffer from addiction, substance use disorders, they're chasing the fentanyl. For those that have had it and survived their drug
mm-hmm.
and that are getting the extra high with fentanyl, they're now chasing that. They want that.
Mm-hmm.
So the dealers aren't worried about whose lives they're taking. Ryan was your typical boy, growing up, active, energetic, loved being outside, loved music, best friends with his brother,
mm-hmm.
15 months older. So they were best friends growing up, played sports together. One thing that I'd like to mention is my kids did play sports and ice hockey for many years. So when my kids suffered injuries, they were given prescription OxyContin.
Mm-hmm.
And I made sure my kids took it because I was the good mom and nobody wants to see their child in pain. I did not know then what I know now
right.
about the addictive behavior. But as Ryan got through middle school and high school, behavior changes, which as a parent of a teenager, you attribute to typical teenage behavior. He started experimenting with marijuana, drinking, which I knew would happen. But I thought he would outgrow it.
Mm-hmm.
But he never outgrew it. He told me he liked the effects of when he was high.
And these are like the gateway drugs that mm-hmm. do, in sad realities, open the door for harder and more dangerous drugs later on.
And I was what I thought was the good parent, and any prescription medications I did not have within my kids' reach. I told my kids about prescription medicines. I taught them about addictive behavior. I taught them about, I didn't know the term substance abuse at the time, but I did tell mm-hmm. them about addictive behavior in the family history.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not enough because the teen brain isn't fully developed. So they're going to experiment. As a parent, you try and be watchful as you can and educate your child and find out where they're going, who they're going with. There were so many things that I thought I did right, but I probably missed a lot of it.
We all miss those things. Mm-hmm. And we're talking about habits here. Habits themselves and in and of themselves are difficult for anybody. I mean, mm-hmm. a bad habit is a bad habit. But when you take a bad habit that is also now tied to a chemical component that actually does, and before we started this recording, you mentioned the phrase rewired his brain.
Mm-hmm.
That impact of kind of changing some of the body chemistry does happen with some of these drugs.
Yes. And when Ryan was 18, he started snorting bath salts. And at the time, the medical community did not know how to help somebody who did that. How it affected him was that when he was using them, it was a complete personality change. He was aggressive. He hallucinated, kicked in windows. One time we had police at our house because he thought we were being held captive. And I believe that affected his brain chemistry in such a way that it was the beginning of the unwiring of his brain.
Mm-hmm.
So when he got off of that, and I don't know how he got off of that. He never told me how he stopped that. But when he started experimenting with other drugs, he never gave his brain the time to rewire and correct itself. And he was told by professionals when he was in rehab, you have to give it at least 2 years to reset your brain.
Mm-hmm.
But for an addictive brain, it's hard for them to get a natural feeling instead of the high feeling.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether the high was to make them like a speed thing or a downer thing, whatever way they were going, but to find that natural component to feel that way.
Did he ever come and talk to you about some of these things that he might have been experiencing that would have maybe brought up some of the negative impacts? Because a lot of these drugs mm-hmm. do carry along with them things that aren't as positive as the feeling of euphoria.
In my opinion, he battled addiction for about 7 years, 18 to 25. So, and we spoke on and off during those years.
Mm-hmm.
I realized that the time that he didn't speak to me is when he was using, because he didn't want mom to know.
Okay. Yeah.
So when we did speak, he made it more about drinking. I thought his addiction problem was alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
I had no idea the extent of drug use that he was using.
Mm.
I didn't know it was that bad because I knew he wasn't doing bath salts anymore. He was working on and off during that time. He wanted to be a successful, independent adult.
Now, you mentioned that he graduated from school, but nowhere near with the potential of a GPA that he would have had were it not for any of these involvements in drugs, right?
That's correct. He was a straight A student involved in sports, after school activities. By the time he got to high school, my straight A student was F's, not doing work, didn't like authority,
mm-hmm.
wouldn't get up for school. It was a battle every single day.
Right. And this is a good exercise for everyone listening who may have someone in their family who is going through some of this. That can be in itself right there, a sudden change in, let's say, performance and grades in school can be a real indicator.
Absolutely. And when you see that, my advice is don't give up.
Mm-hmm.
Don't give up. Don't give up. Don't give up. It's our job to be a parent. It's not our job to be their friend. They will have friends along the way.
Right.
But as a parent, it's find out who they're hanging out with. Monitor everything. I don't think tough love is a solution because I hear from so many parents now that did tough love and they still lost a child.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no right or wrong. But as far as what happened in high school, my son was a completely different person. I used to joke to other parents that I think aliens came and took the soul of my son away, and one day they'll return him because his body's still there, but that's not my child. But one thing is, when parents come to me with their child in active addiction, they ask me, what would you have done differently? That's a hard question. And it breaks my heart because I lost my son.
Right.
But there's a fear. There's such a fear when you're afraid, is your child using? If you don't know, or if you do know, there's so much fear. And the resources aren't out there as much as like the COVID vaccine for people to get help or who to turn to.
And that's one of the reasons why we're doing this very series, because of that very fact, is that a lot of people do not realize that this drug, which again is still being distributed, as are a lot of opioids, and the, most of the painkillers for serious surgeries are still being given. And yet, as we talked with one of our individuals, Kyle, who shared with us, he couldn't take other drugs because he was allergic to some of them. Fentanyl worked.
Right. And some, I'm going to say kids only because I think of Ryan still as my kid, but young adults, or it seems like 20 to 26 is the population we are losing. And it's not just fentanyl. It's other drugs. When Ryan passed, I contacted the police to get police reports to see what Ryan's life had been like that I didn't know. And that was very telling, that there were times Ryan was busted because he was asleep in a car with a friend and he had taken medication from the friend's house.
And that is a common thing, stealing medication that was legally prescribed.
Yes, very much so. So kids will go into the parents' medication and only take a couple. Because how many times do you count how many pills are in there? And it doesn't matter what it is.
And that becomes a source. If they only take one or two, it might not be noticed that much. Because a lot of times people who are taking them legally, they don't ever finish those drugs. And sometimes they're forgotten. And that's one of, again, the reasons why we're aiming this series to culminate on the 24th of April. Because that is National Drug Take Back Day, and that would be a good thing for every person to do, is to go through, take an inventory, find out what you've got, what you're no longer using, and take it back.
What I used to do is twice a year is when you're supposed to check your smoke alarms. So twice a year, check your medications.
Good suggestion.
Yep. Make it a habit when you have to... Because checking your smoke alarm is saving a life. So saving a life, it's the same kind of thread. Check your medications. You don't need it anymore. Bring it to your doctors.
That's good advice. Before we close out and hear more about your the project that you have, the From Project, tell us a little bit. I think this is a really important aspect. Tell us about when Ryan got out of school and started work, and it looked like he was doing great and was on a pathway that might have been an end to the things or the concerns that you would have had.
When Ryan barely graduated high school, he said he didn't want to go to college, and it breaks a parent's heart because you want your child to be successful. But his rationale made sense, that he struggled. He needed something different, so he wanted to go to work. He got a great job at a new restaurant that opened in the state he was living. And he was on the path to success, becoming an 18-year-old manager at the restaurant. But the problem with that, as he was succeeding, is that the people that he worked with were older. They were in their 20s and older than that. So working at a restaurant, they work late. So it was after hours and it was party time. And they're the ones that introduced him to bath salts. At the time when my son passed, I did not know one other parent that lost a child, let alone a child to an overdose. I did not know anybody. I had nowhere to turn. So I went back home in my grief, struggling, and all I heard from people was, have you talked to a counselor? Get help, get help, get help. It got to the point, it made me angry. Mm-hmm. I got very angry. But through my anger, I was never angry at Ryan. Not his fault. Not his fault that he passed away. Not his fault that he struggled. Addiction is a brain disease. I understand that. So what I started was, can I talk about the FROM Project?
Yes, okay. Absolutely.
So the FROM Project evolved because in the grief groups that I found online, specific for grieving moms who lost their child to substance use, and they're private, I saw moms struggle and the pain and the grief, and I felt helpless. It wasn't about my grief. I felt so bad for them. Mm-hmm. And what can I do? And I knew people around me didn't know what to say to me, so they say nothing. So the first thing I did was I connected with one mom online, and she lost her daughter to an overdose a year before I lost Ryan. And I wanted to do something for her, and I didn't know what. But in the same breath, I needed a way to keep my son's memory alive. So what do I do? So I made her a card.
Mm-hmm.
I made her a card, and I sent it to her. And in the card, I personalized it, and I wrote her daughter's name. Because only 3 months after losing Ryan, nobody said his name anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And I sent her the card, and we're still friends to this day. And I felt not only did it help her, it helped my heart. So I started making cards to send to other grieving parents who lost a child to an overdose or substance use disorder. And in it, I have a short summary of Ryan's story.
Mm-hmm.
And I personalize every card with their angel's name.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's nothing like receiving something tangible and then opening it up and then seeing your angel's name. And it doesn't matter when they passed. It's that somebody cares about you.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody's remembering your child's name.
Mm-hmm. That's very important. And
very.
I know that you have t-shirts for this. And I know that it means a lot to you that you are maintaining his presence.
Mm-hmm.
Even though he's not with you, his name is still there. And you're carrying that and you're doing a great job. I've been talking with Mary Beth Moore Zacco. I so appreciate the just honesty and transparency that Mary Beth has been willing to open up her heart and to tell us these stories. You know, it's tough on families, right, JC? I mean, it's difficult. How do you go on from a loss like that?
Right. And it is difficult. And as Brittany said earlier, you know, the overwhelming pull and tendency and pressure is to not talk about it. You know, this is mm-hmm. not a pleasant subject. No one wants to talk about it. But I think it's in talking about it that people who have experience with this can help others in the same position.
This next person I know is someone you know, and you have had interactions with Nicole. Her name is Nicole Dupre, and her husband was injured in an accident.
Yeah, Nicole's story. We actually bonded over both our tragedies when we first met. I told her about my brother. Senator Marco Rubio was passing some opioid legislation, and I was really excited about it. And when we bonded over our shared loss, I guess you could call us kindred spirit.
This is Nicole Dupre.
Yes, his name was Adam. And like so many people like him, he had been a sports player and a bodybuilder and amateur boxer. Well, maybe that's not like everyone. But he, after that, had been hurt on the job. and he was prescribed OxyContin from his, he was a union laborer working here in Central Florida. And it was a doctor that was, given to him through his union office. Mm-hmm. And he was a big guy. He was like 6'3" and he was all muscle. And he was prescribed OxyContin, and he had one of those doctors back, you know, before the crackdown happened, that just wrote him prescription after prescription.
Yeah. Just freely giving this out. And mm-hmm. a lot of doctors did. And this drug is still being prescribed. There was a lot of these, this family of drugs, oxycodone and others like it, they work. I mean, yes. That's why they were prescribed in the beginning. They right. worked. And so few people realized how that they would be abused.
Right. And as for him, you know, it really did help those pains, you mm-hmm. know, and honestly, it reduced not just the pain that he had experienced in that work injury, but, you know, just, you know, those other aches and pains from having worked in sports his entire life. And like I had mentioned, he was a labor worker. So, you know, he had more energy. He could work longer hours. You know, he just was feeling kind of like a new man mm-hmm. at first. It really helped in the beginning. And then somewhere along the way, it just was, he was able to get prescription after prescription. And I don't think that I realized, you know, I was in my early 20s at the time. And
how long had you been married at this point?
At this point, we were relatively newlyweds, mm-hmm. you know, we were married in 2012. And I believe that his accident happened in we were married in 2008. And then I think that this accident happened in 2009.
Okay.
And so we were trying to buy a house. We were trying to start a family. So we were both working, you know, long hours. And I think that at first I didn't even realize just how bad that the addiction necessarily was. I just, you know, kind of took his word for it. And I thought, well, the doctor's prescribing this. Like, these are actual legitimate, you know, medications that he's taking. These mm-hmm. aren't some sort of street drugs. And that's when, you know, we started to hear here in Florida about, you know, wait a second, there are doctors out there, these quote unquote pill mills, these doctors that are writing prescription after prescription, you know, instead of waiting the full 30 days or the full amount that the prescription was supposed to be for. And his particular office, a doctor's office, was closed. Mm-hmm. And this is a problem with a lot of people who have to use their body for work. Laborers here, and not just in Central Florida, but all across the United States, that have a lot of pain and physical pain. And I think that once his doctor's office closed, he just turned to get whatever sort of pain medication he could, whether that was Percocets from somebody else or oxycodone from someone else. And somewhere along the way, he was introduced to heroin.
Mm. Before we get to that, let's go mm-hmm. back to those early days when he's taking this drug. Did he ever tell you any kind of like warning sign that he really needed this drug, or that he might even be concerned about that?
I don't know if he necessarily told me himself that he was concerned, but, you know, hindsight is 20/20, and I mm-hmm. could definitely see, you know, before he even, you know, as soon as he woke up in the morning, you know, it would be, you know, take, you know, more than two or three of them. And then he would just be like, oh, babe, I'm a big guy, you know. And I thought, okay, well, he is bigger than your average man. Then, well, of course, maybe he needs more than this. And mm-hmm. it did start to become a problem. And we actually tried to get him clean and off of them twice, you know, mm-hmm. off of the medication. And we even tried to get him on a medical assisted treatment, something called methadone. And then there was a period of time where he was addicted to the methadone. And methadone is something that you can take that will help to relieve the feelings of addiction towards these other opioids. Mm-hmm. And then we tried to just get him clean at home. And I have to tell you, like, those were some of the longest, most horrible days that I had ever experienced, you know. And as a wife, you'd say, you know, I'm going to be there for my husband, you know, like, for better or worse. Mm-hmm. Like, and so these were definitely some of the worst days. And it just, I mean, I wiped his sweat. I mean, he had cleaned his vomit. We tried. And just to hear, especially somebody who was so strong, like, I always like to say, he was the strongest man that I had ever met. Mm-hmm. And to see him cry out in agony, mm-hmm. you know, and it always resorted back to, I can't do this. I can't get clean. And so he always went back to the drugs. And I don't think that people realize that we have gotten to this, and it's been like this for years, that it was easier for him to buy the street drugs than it was to then go find a prescription. And that's what I think a lot of people don't realize is, you know, you think that, oh, it was just a prescription, and oh my gosh, how does someone get on to heroin? But heroin is something that people can make at home, and you can easily go on the street and buy it.
Well, we've uncovered in a number of interviews the fact that the street drugs that even may be by the same name mm-hmm. are not the same compounds.
Right.
And they are often including fentanyl and other drugs like that that are different from the original compounds, and they're highly addictive. And so they just keep it coming back for more and more and more. How long from the time of the injury to where you knew this was a real problem?
I would say within the first year, mm-hmm. year to year and a half, about a year and a half in, we knew that there was a problem, you know? And that was when one of the first times we tried to get him clean, and or just even at first it started with he couldn't get off of them because he would physically start to get sick. He, you know, his stomach would be upset without taking them. He would shake or start to sweat mm-hmm. and or his extreme back pain. The pain would come back, and he used to say that the pain felt worse now than it did before. And I think in some ways it's probably true because, you know, when you are taking that pain medicine, you're really masking that injury. So mm-hmm. you're pushing yourself even harder and maybe not even allowing your body to recover the way.
Or even further injuring yourself.
Right. And I think too, when it came to the street drugs too, I think that people don't realize too is not just what it does to you physically, but what it also does to you emotionally, or you know, it can take you to a level of euphoria. And I think a lot of people that have experienced some sort of drug addiction also have a lot of maybe, you know, trauma or childhood pain or other emotional pains. And when you start to take these drugs, it makes you feel amazing. Mm-hmm. It makes you feel like you finally have some sort of warm blanket of comfort, you know? And if you've been in physical pain and your body has hurt so long, or if you had some sort of past traumas and are dealing with some sort of emotional pain, it was very easy for people to try to drown either one of those pains, you know, with these drugs. And mm-hmm. a lot of times the street drugs were even cheaper than the prescriptions themselves. Mm-hmm. And that's what I really noticed with him is it started to become, you know, when it turned to the heroin, I could see that it was more than just the physical pain. I could tell that it was tapping into maybe a darkness or a trauma, and it started to unearth or quite, you know, fix other things that he had been feeling in his past. And that's something that I want people to understand is a lot of times, you know, this war on drug addicts is a lot of time it's a war on people who have gone through some sort of trauma, mm-hmm. you know, and you know, there are two types of pain, and sometimes people are trying to really heal both of them.
Mm-hmm. Did he go for treatment along the way other than trying to get clean at home?
Well, back, you know, in 2011 and 2012, there wasn't a lot of options or a lot of things that I knew of, you know, things that, you know, that our insurance would cover. And then that was something, too. We didn't, you know, we were young, and I didn't know, well, if we tried to put you in a facility, is what's going to happen? Is your work going to know? I mean, mm-hmm. he was a forklift driver and operated heavy machinery. You know, if he was on this prescription, he might not be able to work. And then it was, you know, are we going to do this? And I started to become, you know, somebody who was active in the community and working in media. And I didn't necessarily, we both were at that point, we didn't know how much we wanted to let other people know.
Right.
And I didn't know the resources back then. I mean, 8 years ago, we didn't have the help that we have now.
Right. And there's a lot more known now than there was 8 years ago. And that's been the sad saga about this whole thing. And again, why we are making the efforts we're making right now to draw attention
right.
to this problem in a way that people can be proactive and people can actually rid themselves of drugs that are hanging around their home,
right,
that they don't need to have hanging around the home. Because like you said, your husband started looking for these things out of the legal boundaries, mm-hmm, and from places that opened up a whole world of new problems for him.
Right. And like I said, other people that he worked with, other people who had prescriptions, you know, somebody had Percocet or somebody had, you know, Oxycontin, somebody had oxycodone, somebody had, you know, the couple hundred milligrams of Tylenol. Like it started to become whoever had a, mm-hmm, prescription was the one that was sharing it, you know, or maybe this is the person. Oh, can you refill that prescription, or so and so, can you refill that prescription? And these were conversations that I had overheard, you know, mm-hmm, phone calls that I heard him make and arguments that we had along the way.
Because he was convinced that he had to have this.
Yes. You know,
and even though you're calling out for concern or throwing caution toward him, it didn't really matter.
Right. I mean, really, at first, we were newlyweds. We were trying to buy a home. We had this, you know, the more that he could work, the bigger those paychecks would be. Mm-hmm. If he could get that overtime in, and especially for those people that are working in that industry, the more you work, the more money you make. And it was really, I think at first really thought that if we can push through this, the more he could provide for us as we tried to start a family.
Tell us about what happened the time that he really started to crash and you thought he was going to die.
Yeah. I was telling you, that's like the absolute probably worst moment of my life. So we were actually having a wonderful day. It was New Year's Eve of 2011. And I was in the other room and I heard a loud crash. And I came in and I found Adam on the floor. And at first he was shaking violently, and then he was not breathing. His breathing was very heavy and he was struggling.
Mm-hmm.
And I cradled him, and he told me that I needed to call. He was barely able to tell me to call 911. And so I called 911 just as the ball was literally dropping on the television.
Yeah.
And I think really at first, I think I felt like the 911 operator didn't necessarily believe me of what was happening. And he got to this point, and I'm trying to tell her my husband had an overdose, and I don't know what to do. He's barely breathing. He's starting to turn blue. And he whispered to me, I think I'm going. Mm. I love you and I'm sorry.
Mm.
And his eyes started to roll back in his head. And I screamed at the 911 operator, and she told me that I had to calm down or she would disconnect the phone call.
Mm.
And like at that moment, I truly thought he was going to die in my arms at that moment. But luckily, the EMTs arrived and we got him to the hospital in time. And like that was probably also one of the most humiliating moments of my life. You know, I'm wearing Christmas pajamas. It's almost 1 o'clock in the morning. I'm in the emergency room, you know, crying almost uncontrollably. And they only asked me if I had my insurance card and how I was going to pay. They didn't offer me tissue, didn't offer me any sort of resources.
I'm so sorry.
As I was in the emergency room and humiliated. I mean, it just felt like they looked at us like we were, you know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm, junkies or people, mm-hmm, who may be undeserving.
Looking and that's, down on you.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And I think the thing that I fight so hard about is that's not who we were. It's not who he was. And though he didn't die that night, when we came home, he walked right into the kitchen and had pulled out the bag of heroin that he had hidden, and he snorted it right in front of me.
Mm.
And that's when I knew that I had lost my husband.
Mm.
And we went through a few other, you know, years of separation and trying to help him. And then he died on July 10th of 2017.
Still from an overdose.
From an overdose. Yeah. Mm-hmm. From a heroin overdose.
This is such a sad but often told tale. And again, the trajectory as one doctor told us, the trajectory, even from the very beginning. And that's what we all have to realize, is that when these drugs are taken, like OxyContin and other drugs like that, that are indeed even given for these reasons of need, pain, injury, the trajectory points at that kind of a problem of heroin overuse. And you just don't see the end from the beginning often.
Right. And that's just something. And I think, too, is he was the strongest guy I know. So if they're in pain, they obviously need that, because that's mm-hmm. the strongest man that I know. Mm-hmm. And I think that, to me, is sometimes why it was so easy for me to overlook it, you know, because, mm-hmm. well, you can, you know, lift this, or you've always been able to do this. So if you are actually hurting, then you must need it. Mm. And I just, you know, I know that I had heard your last guest. I don't want his life not to mean something. You know, right. I don't want people to just for their last memory of him, that he was just somebody that used drugs, you know, and that's not what he would have wanted his memory to be. And then that's not really, I mean, of course, where he would have wanted his life to have gone. Mm-hmm. And so if I can somehow use my pain and turn it into some sort of purpose, and to show others, not just that, you know, these people that have been through addiction don't deserve, you know, the judgment, but that those of us that have those people in our lives, like, they're not alone. Mm-hmm. And we as a community shouldn't judge other people, that this is something that happens to your neighbor, to somebody who looks like me, to somebody who looks like you. And it's about releasing that judgment and that shame. I think that's the biggest thing. It keeps so many people from trying to get help for themselves, or even trying to get help for their loved one, because they don't want to admit that their loved one or themselves are actually addicted, because there is this preconceived idea of what an addict is supposed to look like.
Mm-hmm. Now, you yourself are an artist. Tell us about how you're using the arts and this organization that you've founded to draw attention.
Yes. So in 2017, I had founded an organization called Opera del Sol, and I'm the creative director of our organization, as well as our sister organization, Central Florida Vocal Arts. So we've created this tale of this one woman's path and life and death through addiction. Mm. And, you know, the kind of five triggering things that kind of help, that have led people that are, you know, your stereotypical, you know, leads to addiction. And we really wanted to create these moments in this show that could help people feel connected.
Again, another wonderful story from Nicole Dupre. And, you know, JC, this also, what she's doing with music, what she's doing in her life, is kind of keeping the same thing that you talked about after Mary Beth's story about moving on.
Yeah, it's so inspiring to see what she's done, you know, and I think it's something anybody can relate to. We all go through difficult circumstances in life, and there's such a strong tendency to allow those to just take us out, to mm-hmm. put us in the gutter for years, you know, and she has turned it around into something where she's now helping others.
This is Mike Gilland and Afternoons with Mike program here on The Shepherd. We will be right back. One of the people that Brittany has met in her work among some of the political arm, if you will, of our culture is our next guest. Brittany, tell us about him.
Chris Anderson, if you know him, is to know a little bit about Jesus's love.
A great joy to welcome Chris Anderson. Chris is the supervisor of elections in Seminole County. Not a small job for you, my man. That's an important job.
It is. Having the opportunity to deliver democracy to voters and give them the opportunity to improve their own quality of life by making the choices of their leaders and the direction of their counties, their state government, and the country is mm-hmm. a huge honor. And I'm very happy to the taxpayers of and the voters of Seminole County gave me the opportunity to remain the supervisor on November 3rd of 2020.
Well, that's wonderful. And congratulations to you on that election.
Thank you very much.
And it's really nice to have you here today speaking on this. I know that if there is anyone that has been affected directly by those who are addicted to drugs and just the horrible impact that it brings, not only to them, but to the family members, and in this case, you know the story. Give us a little bit of what you went through growing up.
You know, I was raised by a single father who had a lot of demons, and his demons were centered around drug and alcohol abuse.
Mm-hmm.
I would come home from school, and there would be naturalized cans all over. There would be crack pipes all over. My father used to say to me that he was a perfect example of what not to be. And every time he would say that to me, it would break me apart, because he was at that time the most important person in my world.
Well, he's your dad.
He's my dad.
Yeah.
And I'm my only child. So I dealt with these things alone. And they will follow you into your adulthood. Something I don't usually share, and I'll share this with you and your listeners today, is, you know, I developed separation anxiety from it. I even at some points I had anxiety and biting my fingers.
Mm-hmm.
I've woken up and been alone when I was very young. My father had been arrested the night before for buying drugs, and I didn't know where he was.
Mm-hmm.
And I always think about our next door neighbor. She was a wonderful lady. I don't know her name. But I ran next door, and she sat with me until a family member could come and retrieve me. And I wish I could meet her today, mm-hmm. you know, just to, I don't know if I ever said thank you,
mm-hmm.
you know, for what she did for me. Cause, I was scared, you know, I was alone. I didn't know where my father was, and, you know, she comforted me in my time of need.
You know, I think about what you say about separation anxiety and waking up in the middle of the night feeling alone. I think every child's gone through that, but their parents are not out of that house. They're there. They're just not in the same room with the child. But in your situation, you would wake up not even knowing your dad was gone, but no idea where he is, only later to find out that he was actually in jail.
Yeah, and you're right. Kids do experience that, but they don't experience it. I was constantly pulled away from him because he was battling those demons, those addictions. So he couldn't be what I needed him to be. So I found myself alone a lot of times. Now, I was very fortunate to have my grandparents who did a lot of heavy lifting.
Mm-hmm.
I had my godparents who did a lot of heavy lifting in regards to raising me,
mm-hmm.
Because they saw that, you know, my father struggled. And it does. The one thing that I always say is your actions don't just affect you. They also affect the people around you that love you the most.
Mm-hmm.
And I always tell people the people that can hurt you the most are your family, because they're the closest to you. And to watch my father suffer, I remember when we picked him up from jail, he was sitting in the passenger seat and I was sitting in the back, and my godfather was driving, and he just started banging the dashboard of the car with his fist, furious. And what he was upset at was himself. He was upset that he had let himself down. He let me down, and he couldn't come to terms with that.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, he looked back at me and he would always say, "Hey, Chris, I'm the perfect example of what not to be." So as mm-hmm. I move through the world today, I'm hoping I'm the perfect example of what he wanted me to be.
That's well said. It's different to say it that way, because I'm sure as many who have gone through this, I have not personally, can't relate at all to what your father was going through, but I do know from talking to many family members, they don't want to do that. It's not like they have it in their heart to hurt their sons or their daughters. In this case, he was obviously feeling very bad about what he had done. And there's that mix at times of responsibility where you feel that you know you're doing something wrong. And yet there's this other side of it when that drug starts calling the name, his name, that it pulls him into doing things that he doesn't want to do. And in fact, with you guys, there were moments of near violence when he would come at you, one involving a knife. Tell us that story.
Yeah, you know, my father was a gentleman. He was very loving. But again, once you're battling those addictions, they become someone else. And you know, my father grabbed a butcher knife and we were having a very heated conversation about him improving. You know, he needed to change his ways.
Mm-hmm.
And he, again, was just very frustrated. And, you know, I flung back into the seat, into a chair, and he just started swinging the knife at me. And it slipped me on my arm here.
Oh, how old were you right then, Chris?
I was a teenager, mm-hmm. because I can remember it, you mm-hmm. know, pretty vividly.
I can't even imagine that.
Yeah, I ran into the bedroom. I barricaded the door. He broke the door down. By that time, I had already crawled out of the window. And I ran down to a store at 1st Street and 43rd Avenue in Vero, and I used a payphone. They don't even have payphones.
Yeah, they don't have those anymore.
I used a payphone to call my aunt, and my father was arrested for aggravated assault, domestic violence.
On his own son?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And I remember sitting in the car, and I'm sorry.
It's okay, man. This is real stuff here.
Yeah. I remember sitting in the car with my grandmother, and I saw the deputy was walking my dad out to his car, the deputy's car, and my father's look. He was in handcuffs, and he looked to his right, and he saw us sitting there, and he looked at me, and I'll never forget that look on his face. It wasn't a look of a sorrow. It was a look of, he was a different person. When he looked at me, he was just a different person. I had actually ended up working for the Indian River County Sheriff's Office later in life. But that was one of those moments that still to this day kind of bothers me.
Now, you strike me as a different example than what many are. Many times people grow up with this feeling that I hate that, but yet their life almost seems like, from their standpoint, they were on a train and that they couldn't stop to become just like that in their own lives. For some reason, you saw some things differently.
I did. You know, like I said, I had my grandparents around, and my grandmother introduced me to Christ. And my faith is everything. Mm. I wouldn't be here today if it wasn't for God's grace. I would not have put my feet on the floor this morning. You know, my father never knew who he was. That was his struggle. He was a black man that was born prior to civil rights. He was fair skinned. He was also gay. I patched up my father's wounds after he was assaulted for coming out of a gay club in Miami.
Mm-hmm.
So he had like layers of things that he was dealing with. And I didn't realize that until later in life. And my father ended up contracting the AIDS virus mm-hmm. in 1997. So I knew that I had to do something different. I had to make my own way somehow. And I chose to go into the military.
The amazing story of Chris Anderson, and JC, it's one more story as we talk about how addiction affects family members. The reason we're doing this is that addiction is powerful, but it is not so powerful that it can't keep the members that are left behind from moving forward.
That's right. And I think it also speaks to the fact that none of us is doomed to anything. You know, we're not fatalists, right? You know, we all have a choice about the path we will take in our own lives. Mm-hmm. And we all have, you know, I think it's pretty common to see in certain families, certain types of sins or tend to run through generations.
Thank you both, Brittany Parks and JC Derrick, for being with us today. And friends, thank you for joining us on this special edition of Afternoons with Mike during the Opioid Awareness Month.